Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I'm a Jewish guy in Birmingham, Alabama, and suddenly I'm relating to this NASCAR crowd, which seemed like a monumental upset.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. In Southeastern Conference football history, the true legends go by just one name. Bear. Herschel. Bo. And now there's another, although you have to stretch it out. Paul. Paul Feinbaum, a thin, bookish former sports writer, has somehow become one of the avatars for Southern football, through his longtime radio show, and now through his TV work on ESPN. A legion of regulars call into the radio show to argue about SEC football, mostly Auburn and Alabama football, and some of them have become celebrities themselves. Feinbaum inspires both love and hate, sometimes in equal degree, by finding the raw nerves of college sports and repeatedly, gleefully poking them. With the college football season starting in just a few days, we thought it would be a good time to check in with football's most unlikely star. Here's our conversation. It's August now, so I think by the time this airs, it'll only be a few days away from the start of a new college football season. Fans are always excited when this sort of thing happens, but I know people who do this sort of thing for a job, sometimes it's nerve-wracking, sometimes it's dread of a whole new season of all this happening. How do you feel when a new season starts?
It's a little bit, Tommy, like when we were kids, as we got into August and the days got slightly shorter, you started getting queasier about school starting because you know the fun and frivolity is over. And I for the first time the other day, as amazing as it sounds in Charlotte, I got cold for a second. It was only 78 degrees. And
right.
I'm starting to think, is the summer over? Because I love the hotter the better for me. And so you all of a sudden, you walk in the middle of July and there's really nothing much going on. And in August, there's this and there's that, and you know it's about to happen, which is, listen, that's what we all do that cover college or pro football, but the age of innocence of the long summer days are coming to a crashing halt.
Could you describe to people what your typical week is like during the season?
It's interesting. We'll start with Monday, I guess. This year is a little more complex than most, but I'll talk about what's ahead. Monday, I'm in studio here. There may be something else going on for the regular network, ESPN. And starting this year, last year I did it one day. This year I'll do it 2 days. I'll fly to New York on Monday night. And I'll do the ESPN TV shows up there in the morning. Get Up with Mike Greenberg, and then First Take with Stephen A. Smith. Then we'll do our show. Yeah, I'll do other stuff up there. Usually do a hit with Stephen A. on his radio show. We'll do our show at 3. And then Wednesday, I'll repeat it. Somebody had the idea that maybe since I was already there, let's squeeze the turnip a little bit more. So because the show doesn't end until 7, and New York airline flights are strange considering it's the biggest city in the country, I can't get out till Thursday morning. So I'll fly back to Charlotte, do our show here. And then Friday morning, I will fly to an SEC campus. We do the SEC's version of game day every week at a different campus. I'll do that. I'll do our show on Friday. Saturday morning is the actual show. I'll do stuff for the network. And then I will fly to Bristol, Connecticut. Saturday afternoon, you go to Hartford, which is just a lovely – when you see Hartford 15 consecutive Saturday nights in the fall, you know that you have reached nirvana. And then I'll do SportsCenter early Sunday morning and try to get back here sometime in the afternoon.
Some of our listeners maybe are not big sports fans. Sure. And so can you kind of explain –
I listen to the station.
could you sort of explain how you got here, if you can – figure out that for yourself?
For the sanctity of time, I'll try to speed this story up to under a couple of days. But my career began as a sports writer in small cities. Eventually got to Birmingham pretty quickly and thought I would be there briefly and do what all young sports writers do, move on to bigger and better markets. And it didn't happen for a myriad of reasons. And I ended up staying in Birmingham a long time. I thought it was a curse. It turned out to be a gift. And about 10 or 15 years into that, I'm not a genius, but I detected something was wrong with the newspaper business. Talking to a longtime newspaper columnist, I have a feeling you're nodding your head rapidly.
You're the canary in the coal mine, so to speak. Yeah.
And I began to dabble in radio. I found I liked it very much. I was not good at it. And that became a conflict between doing a daily radio show and the newspaper column. And when the conflicts came to me, when the newspaper editor would say, well, hey, listen, I need to send you to Starkville, Mississippi tomorrow to cover, I finally said, you know what, I need to be on the radio show. And I continued to write, but my exit from newspapers was being expedited. And at some point, radio took over. I stayed true to writing because I loved it. I continued to do that, but radio became my main thing. And that began to take off. And about in the early 2000, we branched the show out on a network, a regional network. And about 8 or 9 years later, satellite radio picked it up. And I know I'm speeding right down the highway here, but it ultimately in 2013, exactly 6 years ago, landed me a job at ESPN, which prompted the move to Charlotte.
Well, obviously one of the things that happened when you started doing radio is that this sort of cast of characters evolved around you. And I don't know if anybody except maybe Howard Stern, who sort of built that kind of weird, strange family that you've built. Was that intentional in any way, or did it just happen?
It just happened. Radio brings a lot of people to the table, and there are some stereotypical radio callers. But we started getting calls from all types of different people. And one thing that we did early on, we had Christmas lunches, we had events in the summer, so I got to meet some of these people. We would also invite them down, and it took a while, but I started to detect that the callers were the show, and it took on a life of its own. We had a lady named Phyllis who called our show once, and she used some obscenities, and I decided on the spot, I said, Phyllis, you're banned for life. And there was a protest. So we decided to have this is when I knew we were close. So we had a trial.
And we had on the air.
On the air. It was like a 2-hour deal. It just so happened that very day, Warren St. John, who was at the time at the New York Times, he was doing a book called Rammer Jammer, which was a fabulous depth into deep dive into fandom. He told me, he said, at the end of this show, which I'm about to tell you about, he said, I know you've reached the end of the rope. If you can get 2 hours out of this, the football season is definitely over. But anyway, we had a former district attorney, a former judge, and I would prosecute, defend. And at the end, I found her guilty. But I upheld the ban to time served. And this show took off. And then we started getting other people calling in. Tammy started calling, and this one started calling. And it just kept going. And for someone like me who was, even though I was born in the South, my father and mother and my sister were all from New York. I'm a Jewish guy in Birmingham, Alabama, and suddenly I'm relating to this NASCAR crowd, which seemed like a monumental upset on its merit, and it just kept happening, and things began to develop, and a couple of different events occurred, probably a little bit later on, but we got a call one day in 2011 in January from a guy who was angry. He was an Alabama fan, Tommy, who was angry that Cam Newton had been allowed to play at Auburn, the final game of the season against Alabama, of which he led Auburn back from a 24-0 deficit at Bryant-Denny Stadium and beat Alabama. It kept Auburn alive. He played the next week in the FCC championship game. He won the Heisman. They won the national championship. And to this day, Alabama fans do not think he should have played, that he was given money through blah, blah, blah. And so a guy called in January and said, you know, he called him Scam Newton.
Well, let me tell you what I did. The weekend after the Iron Bowl, I went to Auburn, Alabama, because I live 30 miles away, sure. And I poisoned the two tumors trees.
Okay, well, that's fair.
I put Spike 80 DL in them.
Did they die?
Do what?
Did they die?
They're not dead yet, but they definitely will die.
Is that against the law to poison a tree?
Well, do you think I care?
No.
Okay, I really don't.
Okay.
Roll damn tide.
Tommy, I didn't give it much thought. I mean, we get a lot of wackos calling the show. A week and a half later, I'm in my car. I'm driving back from Atlanta. I got a friend of mine called me from Washington. He was a staff member on Richard Shelby, the senior senator's Homeland Security Subcommittee. He said, I just want to let you know, we are currently investigating this guy that called your show. We think he poisoned the water system. We believe it's an act of terrorism. I go, oh my goodness. By the next day, this man whose name was Al from Dadeville was arrested
on the show.
The guy who called it, his name was Harvey Updike, and it became the biggest sports story of the day. That an Alabama fan angry over Cam Newton being eligible and beating his Crimson Tide poisoned these two trees, and these two trees did die.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's where you and I first crossed paths,
exactly.
Because I did a story on that for Sports Illustrated.
Sure.
It turned out everything he said was true, and the trees eventually, they did have to take them down, and it became this incredible moment of where you felt like sports hate, which I always think of as this sort of fake, almost like pro wrestling sort of thing, became this very real moment.
Tommy, people were treating it like a massive or terrible death. I mean, people cried. I mean, everyone was heartbroken, even Alabama fans, even Georgia fans, because who would do this? And what was interesting, and I know this, I'll try to stay away from the current times, but some people blame me and said, you promote this hate on your show. And, you know, I didn't, I just took it with the criticism that it was intended. Well, okay, maybe we do, but, you know, what happened was interesting. About a month or two later, another incident happened in Alabama. This was tragic. On April 27th of the very same year, an F5 tornado ripped through Tuscaloosa, nearly hitting Bryant-Denny Stadium. And Alabama fans, Auburn fans, and really fans of college football came together, and our show became this meeting place. We devoted 6 weeks to this terrible tragedy, and Auburn fans and Alabama fans all worked together, and what can we do? And then one day it just ended. The hate was back, and it hasn't stopped since. But it started to develop even more characters, and one in particular. I'll never forget, you wrote a column right after I landed here, and you asked about what would these people do, including a lady named Tammy. How would she handle the show moving out of Alabama? And in November of 2018, the week before Thanksgiving, Tammy was driving her 2-year-old granddaughter in south of Birmingham, and a tractor trailer went over the median, smashed into her car, and killed both of them. And when we announced that later in the day, it was a Friday afternoon. We happened to be doing the show from Athens, Georgia. It seemed like the world had stopped. For 2 hours, fans called in tears. And a couple of days later, I went back to Alabama and gave the eulogy at this funeral. And yeah, it that was maybe the day that it finally dawned on me what this is all about. I mean, here we, you know, it's one thing to have Harvey Updike, this lunatic who did what he did, but to see fans of the show lined up outside, people that had never met Tammy, coming to pay their respects, I walked out of there really shaken to think that she was a caller. I know she was a mother and a grandmother. Don't misunderstand me. But to these people that showed up, a lot of them, she was a caller on a radio show. And we still get calls to this day about her.
When we come back, Paul Feinbaum talks about the challenges facing college football and the challenges of ESPN trying to cover sports without the politics. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
On Southbound, we always take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank listener Adam Butler. Adam heard our last episode with wrestling announcer David Crockett and said this on Twitter. Tommy Tomlinson's words at the end of each episode are always great, but I think this effort is the best thus far. Thank you so much, Adam, and thanks to everyone else who shared and commented about this episode. If you'd like to be part of the Southbound community, we'd love to hear from you. You can suggest ideas for future guests on our homepage at wfae.org/southbound. You can also reach me directly at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Or you could tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. What really helps is if you leave a good rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the NPR One app. That helps Southbound get out there to even more listeners. Thanks for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Paul Feinbaum. You were, for all those years in Birmingham, in the middle of the Auburn-Alabama rivalry, which is the most intense rivalry, I think, in any sport, you know, probably anywhere on the planet. What is it about those two schools, that place, that makes it burn so much hotter than everywhere else?
Well, it's geography. And living in Carolina, I'm there's a little bit of it going on across the state line between South Carolina and Clemson. And some of it is a result of dominance of one school over the other. When I got to Alabama, I started going out with a young lady who was an Auburn fan, graduate. And she told me that when she would get on a school bus in the mid-70s, that the Alabama fans would spit at her, make fun of her. I mean, this was a second or third grader being abused and mocked because of their school allegiance. That's where it starts. That's coming from parents. And there's a superiority complex that Alabama fans have over Auburn, and it festers. And it changed in the 80s. Auburn had lost, I think, 9 or 10 straight games to Alabama, Bear Bryant. And finally, Pat Dye showed up, and they asked him at his press conference, how long is it going to take to beat Alabama? And he looked straight ahead, and he said, 60 minutes. And it was... It was a revelation, and finally, it took 2 years, two games. But when he did beat Bear Bryant in his final year, 30,000-40,000 fans poured out onto the field. I mean, I was down there as a young reporter, and I was in fear of my life. A couple of years later, the game used to always be in Birmingham. Dye moved the Alabama Auburn game to campus, and in 1989, it followed a very monumental world event. Asked after the game what the experience was like, he said it's the closest thing to tearing down the Berlin Wall
everybody has the proper perspective. Here.
And you know, I don't know if you know, Dye had just heard that on the news because Pat Dye did not look like somebody who studied world history very closely. But I mean, that's how important this rivalry was. In some ways it's diminished because the dominance is so over the top, but you still had that game in 2013 So Alabama and Auburn, Alabama's undefeated. They're number one in the country. They're trying to win the national title for the third straight year. And they have a 10-point lead against Auburn. They can't put the game away. And finally, it comes down to it looks like the game is going to overtime. And Nick Saban, being the greatest coach of all time, decided, you know, I think there may be a second left. So he went to the officials. He challenged it. They found there was 1 second left. They put 1 second back on the clock. Alabama attempted a 57-yard field goal.
Does not have the leg. And Chris Davis takes it in the back of the end zone. He'll run it out to the 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 45. There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game. He ran the missed field goal back. He ran it back 109 yards. They're not going to keep him off the field tonight. Holy cow. Oh, my God. Auburn wins.
And so things like that do happen, and it just intensifies the rivalry even more.
So, as you said, this rivalry has been going on forever, you know, for years and years and years. But you also seem to have hit the vein in that when you started out. And I know I have friends who feel both ways about this. I have a good friend who thinks Paul Feinbaum sort of stirred it up, and that's what makes it worse. And I have other friends who say, well, it was there all along, and he just kind of found the point. What, how do you ever feel like you're stoking the flame, so to speak?
Well, yes. If we could go off the record here for a second, you're
off the record here while both microphones are on? Sure.
Former newspaper guy, you would. I take some responsibility. But what the advantage that I had was that I didn't really care about either school. I came in there. I went to school at Tennessee, which some people think is really a big deal or was a big deal. It's not a big deal. I believed in trying to be as objective as I could. And I knew one thing. Once I became a columnist, the objective every day was to stir someone up. And one day it was Alabama, and the next day it was Auburn, and it just worked. And that was as a newspaper person. So by the time I got to talk radio, I had figured out the system pretty well. And it wasn't difficult in a state like that where most of the media tries to be 50-50. I mean, you've been at newspapers a while. We got to give Clemson coverage. We got to give North Carolina. I didn't really care. I just, whatever the hottest story was, and if somebody was suffering as a result, then so be it.
Right. So pull back a little bit just from that particular rivalry or whatever. I think a lot of people don't understand or maybe resent the amount of attention given to the SEC, all that sort of thing. First of all, why has the SEC been so dominant?
Well, I think it's a result of a couple of things. It started about 15 years ago when Nick Saban was at LSU. They became a power. Urban Meyer went to Florida with Tim Tebow, and they won a couple of championships. And even Les Miles, who's one of the goofiest people in sports history, won a national championship. And then this Alabama. I mean, Alabama has won 5 of the last 10.
Right.
And if you're over there in South Carolina today, going, well, yeah, we beat them twice. Yeah, think about that. Alabama has won 5. They've lost 2. They lost in another time in the playoffs. So, I mean, they have been there practically every single year. So that helps. And somewhere along the way, where the SEC won 2 or 3, they started what I found to be a fairly obnoxious chant, this SEC, SEC.
Right.
And it's taken hold. And the conference wears it on its sleeve. And it rubs a lot of people the wrong way. When you go to an SEC event, you'll see Southeastern Conference, and then right under it, there is a saying that they used a marketing firm to come up with entitled "It Just Means More."
I was going to ask you about that. Do you feel like that's true?
I would prefer not discussing the "It Just Means More" campaign. I mean, I don't like it myself. I think it's...
But do you think it's true?
No. I don't. I've been to Clemson a number of times. I mean, I promise you, it means as much to those people as it does in Auburn or Alabama. there are pockets where it does. Virginia Tech, they're not shirking their love of college football there. I just think it's become a way. The SEC just walks down the street and basically tells everyone else to get out of the way. And now I don't want to act like I'm completely innocent in this. 5 years ago, this month, I, with the help of HarperCollins in New York, published a book entitled "My Conference Can Beat Your Conference: Why the SEC Still Rules College Football." Now,
so yeah, you played a little part in that.
there's a lot of arrogance in that, but I was representing the Times. Since then, I have grown weary of that title, and because I've matriculated it at ESPN, I do cover things other than the 14 SEC schools or the one school that we talk about all the time. And I get there are a lot of other places that really do matter.
I want to ask about college football in general. You know, as a lifelong fan, the sport I care about the most, I'm increasingly squeamish, I guess, maybe the right word, about what I'm actually watching and rooting for year after year, from concussions to recruiting scandals to the whole idea that these players who are generating hundreds of millions of dollars for the universities don't get paid a cent beyond the in-kind fact of their scholarships, while the coaches, obviously the top ones, Nick Saban, Dabo Swinney, are making $8, $9, $10 million. How do you feel about covering this sport that has so many inherent conflicts and contradictions?
It can be difficult, because I agree with you. I think it's a seriously challenged sport right now, and you know, there's some issues even beyond that. But I think it's hard to look past the concussion. We both know a lot of ex-players, and it's sad to see. I mean, I've run into people my age, and I'm like, I look at them and I go, yeah. How do they look so old? I'm not trying to act like I look like I'm 25. I don't.
Right.
But it takes a toll. It is a very dangerous sport. But and the players don't get anything. Dabo Swinney just signed a new contract. Makes almost $10 million a year.
And has said many times that if the players got paid, he wouldn't want to coach.
Yeah, anymore. I mean, that is the height of hypocrisy. The players need to get something. You have a president of the NCAA who said that will happen over his dead body. Well, he needs to be replaced. But I think some of this angst is catching up. I believe one of the biggest issues, if not the biggest issue in college football today, in addition to concussions, is attendance. Look around Labor Day weekend, the next couple weekends, and you will see empty seats. There is very little demand. The Alabama-Duke game, which is the kickoff game in Atlanta this year, you can go online and get a ticket for $70 or $80. And I recommend showing up at the game without one, and you'll be given free, because it's there. And you know why is that? Well, now we're sitting here in a ESPN studio. Do you want to blame the networks? Well, the schools are all taking the money. You know, the SEC network, which I was hired as the first person to work for, is been unbelievably successful. Estimates are all over the place, but if you combine the SEC network with the college football playoff package, each school is getting close to $40 million a year. That pays a lot of bills. The ACC
that's before anybody sits down at the stadium, right?
The ACC network wasn't caused wasn't created to put volleyball games on. It was created to put football and basketball games on that would benefit the member institutions. So television is a problem. The experience is a problem. You go to a game on August 31st in Clemson. You think it's going to be cool? You've got to drive for 2 hours. You got to find a parking space. You got to pay through the roof to get your tickets. And a lot of people, we spent an enormous amount of time this summer, Tommy, talking about this on our show. And a lot of fans have just said, you know what, why do I need to go? And young people, the students that this sport is supposed to be for, they don't want to go for a lot of reasons, but primarily they can't stay in touch with their friends online when they're sitting in the middle of the student section. that matters.
Right. Do you find a moments when you wake up and wish you didn't have to care about sports that day?
Yes, I do. But you are disciplined in no matter what you do. And, yeah, you walk in here and the show starts at 3. And at 3:25, you're going, how are we ever going to get to 7? And then something happens. But, yeah, I think you go back to the former newspaper person in me that when something happens, though, time moves very quickly. I'm not saying you want to come in and have something, some news break, but yeah, it does keep you energized. And the one thing about a live show, Tommy, is you don't know when something is going to happen. You never know, and you have to be aware. You just can't say, oh, I'll just kind of keep. I mean, you look up and the world can change in a nanosecond.
You said before that you didn't really want to, you were trying to avoid some mention of the kind of the times we're in, but I do want to ask a question about that. So last
let me get my ESPN policy book out here for a second.
So last year, before football season, I interviewed Spencer Hall, and at the end of the interview, he talked about something he had written about the 2016 election, and basically his point was, we're all Southerners now, that the sort of back and forth and the, you know, vitriol, even if it's for good fun or whatever, all the stuff that we sort of think of as like SEC football talk and that sort of thing is now sort of front and center in the way that politics operates. How do you process that?
Unquestionably. And politics and has always been probably my first love. I as a kid, I read every book about every president. In third grade, I got up in front of the assembly and got all the presidents correct in order. The other day, my wife asked me, like, who was the 12th president? Okay. She said, are you out of your mind? but politics has become really hard to watch, even for me and for almost everyone now, because it is... I'll go back to the conversation we had earlier. Alabama is Trump, Auburn are the Democrats, or you can reverse it. It's kill or be killed. There's no in between, and I find it rather sad because I am fascinated by politics and by politicians, but the media plays a big role. I was in Washington last year speaking to a group of SEC fans, of all things, and I had breakfast with a friend of mine who works at CNN and covers the White House, and I said, well, she was unhappy about the Trump treatment that day, and I said, well, you people are as biased as he is, and she goes, are you out of your mind? I said, well, listen, I can sit. I know bias when I see it, and I think all the media is very biased, and I don't know how you... I wonder how you can trust anything you see nowadays. And that comes from somebody who believes very strongly in integrity and in the principles of journalism. But everyone has their angle. And it's baffling to me where people go to try to find a modicum of objectivity. It's not easy.
In a more micro sense, and I guess in a more direct way, I know there's been a lot of discussion in the media and probably internally at ESPN about how you guys, hosts and commentators and that sort of thing, deal with political issues. I know Dan Le Batard kind of went off on President Trump a few weeks ago, and there was some idea, is he going to get punished for that in some way, that sort of thing. I don't know whether that comes up as much in your realm, but have you thought about how to deal with that, and how do you feel like a sports network should deal with these things that are going on in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I hear from callers. We had Christine Brennan on our program in January. She's a USA Today columnist. And the subject was President Trump feeding Clemson fast food.
Yes.
It was a big deal. We had it live on the air, and we were watching it. Now, I thought the whole thing was really entertaining, whether... I don't eat fast food very much, but they seem to like it. She came on and unloaded on the president, saying it was just outrageous that he would do this, especially while the government was shut down. And for the next hour, I mean, I didn't know what world I was living in, because I was being attacked, castigated, eviscerated, and just chewed up and spit out by our callers, who couldn't believe that we had her on. And I realized then maybe we should steer clear, because there are no easy answers. I am acutely aware of where the majority of our audience resides. But we also have people listening in New York and L.A. and Canada. So you can't say because your core audience is in the South that you should cater to one versus the other. So I do a pretty good job of steering it away. If a caller says something about President Trump, I try to let it go without much comment. But I don't feel compelled to walk in here and share my political views. And there's a reason. I'm not sure I know what my political views are anymore, Tommy. I grew up the son of two New York liberals, found my own path in politics, have been on every side of almost every issue. And I'm not just saying that to be politically correct, but right now I have never been more confused about the politics of this country.
To wrap up, I want to try to give you something even more fraught than that. Who's going to win the championship this year?
Well, I think it's easy. If you play the eeny, meeny, miny, mo game, it's Alabama's turn. And I think when Nick Saban can sit around and talk about failure, and he used the phrase not long ago that we can't afford to waste a failure. He was 14-1 last year and lost a national championship. And it seems like when you're around him, and I have been around him a couple of times lately, that they were 5-7. I mean, they were. I've seen happier people at South Carolina after losing to Virginia 28-0 in the Belt Bowl than I've seen at Alabama this year. But that's just the way it is. And I think Clemson, which is an extraordinary program right now, it's hard to repeat in anything, and I think especially in college football. So I've given you. I could have just said Alabama, but it's not because I spent a lot of my life there, but I see something in Nick Saban's eyes, even as he turns 68 years old. But, I mean, he's young. I saw something on Mick Jagger the other day. He's 75.
So if Mick can still go at 75, surely.
Oh, you can easily coach at 68 if Mick Jagger can get on a stage and dance across the platform and sing Sympathy for the Devil.
Paul, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Tommy, it was my pleasure.
College football is such a strange and wonderful sport. By and large, it's not played in the big cities. It finds its home in places like Norman, Oklahoma, and Starkville, Mississippi. It's deeply tied to weird local customs. The mascots are often living creatures. Bulldogs dozing on the sidelines, war damn eagles landing right on the field. All these eccentricities are even more pronounced down here in the South. So in a way, it makes a strange sort of sense that Paul Feinbaum is down here at the center of it. He doesn't look like, act like, or sound like he should be one of the voices of college football. But this sport, more than any other, embraces the weirdness and wildness of life. Knowing what we know about the corruption and conflict at the center of it, it's hard to justify watching year after year. But for now, it's one of those contradictions I'm willing to live with. The season is about to start, and I can't wait. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where we have show notes for each episode with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.
Next time on Southbound, we talk to musician and author Ben Folds on playing piano, making mistakes, and the occasional perils of a Southern accent.
When I went to University of Miami, I really found out what a liability it could be with the most ignorant people that I ran into. I mean, I remember being at a bank one time. I was just trying to make a deposit. I'm like, I like to make a deposit. And I was like, I'd like to make a deposit. Like right back to me, like I'd said it like Jim Nabors or something. Like, ridiculous.
That's the next episode of Southbound, coming soon. Y'all join us.